Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The United States Supreme Court has ended the suspense on one of the major issues still undecided as the term draws to a close. That would be affirmative action. We'll get you up to speed on today's legal roundtable. We'll also be discussing legal issues simmering in Missouri and Illinois. Lots to talk about today. Joining me in studio, Bill Freivogel, director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith, assistant vice chancellor at Washington University. He directs the Career Center there. And with us for the first time is Kimberly Jones, senior staff attorney with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Kim, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you so much. Well, here we are. We were all expecting and I think hoping for purposes of this program that the High Court would decide some of the issues we've been talking about all year, DOMA, gay rights Proposition 8, and also the voting rights issue. But all they came down with today that was among the biggest issues before them was the affirmative action situation in Texas. Mark, get us started on that. What did the court decide?
Well, it was different than what I think we were all expecting. We were expecting some major kind of change in the law that, I mean, at least for me, I was expecting that they would overturn and say we can't have affirmative action anymore. What they said was that diversity in education is a worthwhile goal, and we're going to recognize that, but we're going to look at the way you implement your diversity procedure with strict scrutiny. And strict scrutiny is a very tough standard to meet. So it could be kind of the coming of the end. Basically, there are two ways that kind of the court looks at laws that are passed. One is called the rational basis test. Does this make any sense at all? And if it does, we'll let it go. But if it's an area that affects a fundamental right, then they tend to look with strict scrutiny, and it's much tougher standard to meet.
Bill Freivogel, did the court punt on this one?
Well, yeah, you could say, I guess, that they punted or they compromised. I mean, affirmative action has been just eking through for about the last, ever since Bakke in 1978. Bakke was the first decision where the Supreme Court said that narrowly based affirmative action, where you just give us a minority student a plus in admissions, was constitutional to achieve diversity. So the only and today again, the Supreme Court said we're going to make this decision based upon Bakke, and then on a more recent one that they decided about 10 years ago, which involved the University of Michigan Law School, which again said that you can have very narrowly based, careful affirmative action to achieve diversity. So they're saying that the only compelling state interest that exists that justifies affirmative action is diversity. But there's two parts to this strict scrutiny inquiry that the court applies in this kind of case. And one is compelling state interest. So the Supreme Court said today that there was a compelling state interest. The University of Texas was trying to achieve diversity. But they said that the lower court hadn't looked carefully enough to see if it was narrowly tailored to achieve that goal. And they added some language that might have tightened the screws a little bit on what is strict by saying that there really has to be no other way to achieve it. I think affirmative action in a way remains where it's been since 1978, barely constitutional.
But can they send it back to the lower court?
Yes, these procedural decisions are always unsatisfying for the public, I guess, because the court's opinion basically saying that's the way the law has been, and the Fifth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, simply didn't use the right test, so it's a do-over.
It was a 7-2 decision. Is that
I think it was 7-1. Kagan was
recused himself.
The lone dissenter was Justice Ginsburg, who said it was clearly the University of Texas plan. She thought was clearly constitutional under previous decisions. Two of the justices who were in the majority, Scalia and Thomas, made clear that they don't believe in affirmative action. The only reason that they didn't that they joined in the opinion was that the court had not been asked to throw out Bakke and the University of Michigan case. Thomas has a very long dissent in which he says, and this is an insight, I think, into his iconoclastic view of race. He says that, you know, back in the times of slavery, it was said that this was a benign institution that was good for blacks. And then at the time of segregation, that segregation was benign and actually good for blacks. And he says this is just like that.
Affirmative action was not benign for Clarence Thomas, however, was it?
No.
But he won't put his Yale law degree up on his office, right? Isn't that true?
He
won't visit Yale Law School, and he's very bitter about it, apparently.
Did this ruling today tell us anything about the court that we didn't know before?
I think it sort of reaffirms the notion that they try to find this Roberts Court does try to find, you know, some sort of a compromise. I mean, you wouldn't have, if you had been putting out the betting line in Las Vegas on whether or not you would have Justices Scalia, right, Thomas, Sotomayor, Breyer, Alito, Roberts, and Kennedy all on the same side in this, yeah, nobody would have wanted to take that bet. So it is a little surprising, and shows compromise.
Two other things that I think are kind of interesting about this case. The first thing is this narrowly tailored test. I mean, that's a really hard test to meet. And I mean, it almost, and I kind of vaguely remember this from law school, I mean, it was almost like nobody's going to meet this test. So it's, you know, they're sending this back to the Court of Appeals, but I think they're going to have the Court of Appeals is going to have a tough time saying, yeah, this is narrowly tailored. The second thing is this case was one of the first argued. It was in October. So we've been waiting forever. So kind of reading between the lines, you wonder, you know, were there earlier drafts? Were they maybe trying to make a bigger decision? And like Bill said, since they're trying to get consensus, maybe they had to cut back and change it. So the other thing, this is the third thing, there's another case coming in the fall. The state of Michigan had a voter initiative to ban affirmative action, and now that's being appealed to the United States Supreme Court. So it'll be interesting to see how that's – I mean, that'll be the next step, I think, in this process.
There were other decisions announced today, less dramatic than some of those that we've talked about. Kim, I know you're up to speed. Could you give us a quick overview of some of the things that were decided today, particularly those that might have real relevance here?
Sure. There was a decision in a Title VII case where an employee was trying to bring a Title VII action against her employer for discriminating against her. And the issue in that case had to do with whether the person who was harassing her and discriminating against her based on her allegations was her supervisor. And that's because under the Supreme Court precedent, if the supervisor has done these things, then there's strict liability for the employer. And in this case, the person who was conducting the harassing was the plaintiff's coworker, and she said, this was my supervisor because she could assign me tasks. And the Supreme Court said, no, a supervisor is someone who can make a decision about your employment.
All right. Okay. And do we have any indication as to when the biggies are going to come down? That would be DOMA Proposition 8 and voting rights.
Well, they're meeting again tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. and probably will also have another decision day later in the week. So I would say sometime between tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. and the end of the week.
Yeah, that would seem to make sense. There was also something I just happened to notice before we went on the air, and that is that the court has decided it was going to review the recess appointment process.
I saw that too, yes.
And this, of course, comes at a time when President Obama has just made some key recess appointments, has he not, for the federal bench?
Well, he has made a number – President Obama has made a number of recess appointments. As a matter of fact, I think – I mean, as far back as in my experience, at least, you know, Ronald Reagan made quite a bit of use of those. They've been used by almost all presidents since. I think the question – I haven't actually read the briefs in this case, but I think the question is, so what is a recess? I mean, is a recess have to be like between Congresses, or can it be when they just go off for Easter break or something?
It's not dealing with the president's right and authority to make a recess appointment.
Well, whether he can make it, not whether that right exists under, you know, at all, but whether it exists during particular periods of time when he has exercised it. You know, what the Congress has done is they sort of leave somebody around in the House to sort of keep them in actual session, even though they're not actually doing any business. So just sort of pro forma session. And so the question is, does that count as a recess? One other thing on the case that Kim mentioned, and then there was another discrimination case involving what the standard should be on retaliation. I noticed that Justice Ginsburg was reading from the bench. You know, she's a very strong backer of opponent of appointment discrimination in her whole history as a justice and as a lawyer. And she was reading from the bench and saying that Congress should overturn these decisions of the court, just as they did back in that Lilly Ledbetter case a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these were two pro-employer decisions.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Make it much harder for the employee to make a case. Yeah.
Let's a couple of other things while we're talking about the Supreme Court, and we can just go over these rather quickly. One of the decisions earlier this month concerned the DNA swabs. It's a big boost yeah. for law enforcement, is it not?
I think so. I mean, they're saying you can take a swab of a person and run it through the database.
A person much, arrested but not yet convicted,
right. And much like what we've done with fingerprints. So they're making the analogy. It's like fingerprints, but Justice Scalia was kind of he was very upset about that decision and said, we're taking basically innocent people and running them through the database to find out. And, we've talked about this before. Technology is rapidly changing. The law is not good when technology is rapidly changing and they have to make up their mind. And we had the decision, was it last year or earlier this year, about the tracking devices on cars?
It was last year.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they came on that one. They said, well, this is different from following, but you can tell they're having a hard time figuring out what to do with all this technology.
It takes a while to catch up.
And there was recently a case involving when you can strip search somebody who's arrested and being put in general population. And this one was it all turned on this arrestee, the balance between the law enforcement purposes and the privacy interests. And the majority went to a lot of trouble to sort of, in Scalia's opinion, concoct law enforcement purposes that really didn't exist.
Yeah, Justice Kennedy, who wrote this opinion, also said, this is just like a mugshot or a fingerprint. Part of the booking process.
Part of the identification.
Part of the identification of who is this person. And, Scalia said, that's ridiculous. We don't get the results back from the DNA until long after this identification process. It's just to try to figure out if it might be guilty of some crime we don't know he's guilty of.
Before we take a break, I want to get to two other items concerning the Supreme Court. One is the fact that it rejected Arizona's voter ID law. But what caught my attention about that was that Justice Scalia, at the time of the decision, actually gave something of a roadmap, if you will, for how to bypass this problem. How unusual is that, that a sitting justice would say, here's the way to do it next time, folks?
Well, I guess it's you would – that's sometimes referred to as dicta. It's not like part of the holding of the case. It's not what the case stands for. But it's not – I guess dicta is not that unusual. I mean, maybe he took this a little bit further than sometimes. But, yeah, I guess his opinion was seen as a very sort of strong statement of Congress having the power – to determine the manner in which elections occur. But then, like you say, he gave this sort of roadmap saying states control voter registration. And here's how Arizona might require proof of citizenship that the federal motor voter law does not require.
That's what this was all about, proving citizenship and registration.
But in many ways, it's not that different from the dissent in these two employer cases that we just talked about, where they say, well, you can always change the law if you want a different result. So I didn't get that worked up about it. I mean, he's a smart guy.
Well, but the state legislatures particularly love that when the Supreme Court says, because they often just throw up their hands and say, what do we do? We're trying to do this. I mean, I think that was true of some of the laws restricting the picketing at funerals. The states were trying to figure out how to craft their laws to make it work.
Well, I have one other item, but I have to take this break. Let's do that now. This is Legal Roundtable Day. With me in studio is Mark Smith from Washington University, Bill Freivogel from the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale, and Kim Jones is with us, Senior Staff Attorney with the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable discussion. Senator Durbin from Illinois has asked John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, to allow live audio of all public proceedings, saying public scrutiny of Supreme Court proceedings will produce greater accountability, transparency, and understanding of our judicial system. Bill, you sent that article to me. your thoughts about that and its chances of being accepted by the Chief Justice?
The chances, I would say, are zero. I mean, particularly since this is he's asking him to do it this term, but you know, this week, to hear these the announcements from the bench of these big decisions that still remain. Now he's also got a bill that I think our inspector used to push, which would require the court to permit broadcasting. And you know, I think that law itself could have some kinds of constitutional issues that can't the court decide on its own. I mean, isn't that totally within the court's jurisdiction to decide? I think it probably is, and I don't think this court is very interested in having cameras of any sort.
They do release audio afterwards,
well,
right?
He is asking for audio. He's not asking for video, is he?
I think he wants it live, though, and they don't do it live.
Yes, he wants live audio.
He wants live audio of the justices announcing the decisions from the bench. You know, when they all get on the bench at 10 o'clock, and then they announce the decisions from the least senior to the chief justice. And sometimes they will read from their opinions. Sometimes they will read at length from their opinions. What they read from the bench does not count as law. It sometimes will explain what the opinion says. But, I mean, so they don't I don't think that they really want to have that
And the article I saw said he wanted to televise. So I think he's talking – video, but I don't think it'll
happen. Kim, you're shaking.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, I did not
no,
see
that's a huge issue in the federal courts, sure. And the judges talk about it at their conference meetings a lot. Yeah. Yeah. And you've heard all the reasons for not televising proceedings, but I'm not sure that live or that recorded audios of the Supreme Court proceedings are available now.
Well, for example, in the big cases, so for example, Obamacare and the DOMA cases. There was audio available by the end of the day,
right,
when the arguments occurred. It wasn't yeah, simultaneous,
yeah,
but it was at the end of the day. And then I think even these statements of the justices that they read from the bench when they issue their opinions do eventually come out at the end of – it may be like at the end of the term. The Supreme Court turns over all of its audio to that Oyez group that puts cases on its website, and I think they transcribe the audio and put the transcriptions on their website.
You can't listen to it.
I don't think you can listen
and
to it.
It's their decision what gets released. Some of the lower courts of appeals like ours, the audio is available online after the arguments.
After the arguments. Well, let's get a little closer to home here. The Missouri Supreme Court, since we last got together, upheld the Turner Law. School districts are scrambling as a result of that. Upheld the constitutionality of the state law requiring unaccredited school districts to pay for students to attend other nearby schools. Does this put that particular issue to rest? We've been talking about that for a long time, it seems.
No, I don't think it puts it to rest. I mean, the reason it's still going on is because the legislature hasn't dealt with it, and they need to deal with it. And there was an editorial in the Post this morning saying, you know, the woman at the, I don't know what the Department of Education, let's say for Missouri, is probably going to be forced to do something, and then the legislature is going to throw up their hands saying, you can't do that. But they haven't done it yet. And so they've been busy outlawing Sharia law and things like that. So I think it'll get pushed over, and hopefully they'll act this year, because I mean, it's everyone's saying this is not workable, the result. We need some kind of process to regulate how many students. What I was seeing, I think the city of St. Louis has about 30,000 students in the school system. They're predicting 10,000 of them will go to the county, and then they have to pay for transportation as well. Mm-hmm. And so the superintendent of St. Louis is saying this will break us.
But the big change that's happened since, I mean, that's not going to happen because St. Louis has got provisional.
Well, that's true. Yeah, St. Louis is now provisional. Yeah.
So
they're
the,
out of it.
The
you're
impact
exactly right
in St. Louis of this decision is not as great as it would have been. I mean, I think
we still have
Normandy,
right,
Review Gardens, and some other school districts that have lost accreditation. I mean, what this law says is that if your child is going to an unaccredited school, the child can go to, I think it's an adjacent school that is accredited, and the school district that's unaccredited will have to pay for the transportation and have to pay for the tuition, and as Mark said, when St. Louis was unaccredited, and it looked as though, you know, there could be 15,000 students or 10 or 15,000 students crossing lines. St. Louis would have had to end up paying most of its budget to pay for their tuition and transportation, wouldn't have had much money left for the 15,000 students who would have remained. But because they now have provisional accreditation, that's sort of off the table. What the Supreme Court said was this doesn't violate the Hancock Law. You know, the Hancock Law says you can't impose a new obligation on a local government without providing money.
An unfunded mandate.
They said this was not an unfunded mandate because it wasn't a new level of service. Clayton, Webster, those districts, their job always was to provide K through 12 education for eligible students. And just the fact that they might have twice as many eligible students was not a change in the level of service provided. They also said that the state legislature, I mean, it would have meant money going from one school district to another. And they said that the Hancock amendment has nothing to do with sharing money between localities, only that the state can't impose an unfunded mandate.
How quickly does this have to be implemented?
August 1st is when the students I think I'm right in saying that what I've read is that by August 1st, the student's parents would have to request to go to a different district. And Kansas City is a real mess because, you know, this case was from St. Louis. But presumably the Missouri Supreme Court decisions applies, it's an interpretation of state law. It would seem to apply across the state in Kansas City, which is unaccredited. But I just heard on your news this morning, that the Kansas City people were taking the position that because there's a separate Kansas City case, that they don't have to do anything yet. They don't have to allow the Kansas City kids into their
districts. This is a court of a – Wait, no, this, no,
this is
Supreme
Missouri
Court.
Supreme Court.
So, wait,
I don't know how they
not a really good legal position.
Mark, you mentioned Sharia law. Let me just say for the record on this program that Governor Nixon vetoed the Sharia law bill. So all of that work that our legislators did to get that written and passed goes for naught, as everyone expected would be the case, if I may add.
And
that.
What was interesting was I forgot who the senator or rep who sponsored the bill, but he was outraged saying that Governor Nixon wasn't straightforward about it and that he had some hidden agenda. And it was like, man, pot meet kettle. I mean, it just seems so ridiculous to say that when they're passing this law when there's no problem whatsoever.
That's right. That was it was addressing a problem that didn't exist,
yes,
I think
exactly.
Was the words. One other thing we want to mention, and that is the fact that St. Louis's red light camera law has been upheld. Anyone want to comment on that? I mean, it's still there and still will be.
Yeah, well, I'm not unbiased because I've gotten a couple of those tickets, so I'm opposed to it, and I was very upset.
Well, I hope you paid them.
I did pay them. Well, I gave them to my wife to pay, right?
It's not a surprise, though.
Yeah, right.
The next issue I'd like to put on the table is the status of the Illinois gun control law. To me, this is like following the bouncing ball. I'm not quite sure where it is, where it's going. Can anyone enlighten me as to where we are with that? A bill has been passed. A concealed weapons bill has been passed.
Right, and so that's before the governor.
Before the governor.
So it began with a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision some months ago saying that Illinois' ban on carrying concealed weapons was unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. They gave the legislature 180 days to pass a law complying with their decision. The legislature, the Republicans and the Democrats passed a compromise law that says you can carry a concealed weapon, but you can't have one in like a, on public transit. You can't have one in a stadium, all sorts of public places that you cannot have them. You can't. However, you can have a concealed weapon in public that could carry as many as 19 rounds. Okay, so that passed the legislature.
And that's before the governor now.
That's before the governor. And Governor Quinn has been a proponent of gun control, and so is thought to be likely to veto it. In Illinois, there's also something called the amendatory veto, which means that the governor can just add provisions to a law. Then it goes back to the legislature and they can reject it. Now, Mike Madigan, who has a political interest in just about everything, but particularly in this, since his daughter is going to run against Quinn in the race for governor.
She's the attorney general.
So Lisa Madigan is the attorney general.
Right.
And Michael Madigan is the Speaker of the House. And Michael Madigan predicts that if Quinn vetoes, that the legislature will override his veto. That would take Lisa Madigan, his daughter, off the hook.
However, let me just stop you here. She's got a role to play in this, too,
right,
because she's just been given some additional time to appeal the original decision, does she not?
That's why it takes Lisa Madigan off the hook. It would take Lisa Madigan off the hook, because then she would say, hey, we complied with the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. There's nothing. It's moot. There's nothing for us to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So she wouldn't have to make this tough decision, which she's been delaying and delaying and delaying.
Are you following all of this, Kim?
Well, I always think about, you know, what the practical effect is of these laws that you can or can't carry a concealed weapon if it's concealed. But it has a lot of effect on law enforcement because they will want to stop people. One of their reasons might be they think they're carrying a weapon. They have reason to think they're carrying a weapon. Or that can be a reason for arresting people. But if they have a permit to do it, then that does hamper law enforcement. That's why they don't like all of this.
Yeah, the law enforcement doesn't like the idea of people carrying guns concealed or otherwise because it is a threat to them.
Perfectly understandable. Yeah. They're the ones most likely to get shot by them, probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to go to the phones because we have a couple of calls relating to things we've already talked about, although there is still much to talk about. Let's bring in Stacy, who wants to talk about the public schools, I believe. Go ahead, Stacy.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the interesting conversation. I'm calling on behalf of St. Louis Public Schools. My name is Stacy Clay, and just wanted to confirm the fact that St. Louis Public Schools is provisionally accredited.
Right.
So as it relates to the court case that you were discussing earlier involving students from unaccredited districts going to accredited districts, the impact of St. Louis Public Schools would be more we could potentially get students.
Right.
But even that is... Even that is uncertain, but just wanted to confirm that we are provisionally accredited, and so the exodus of students is not an issue for St. Louis Public Schools.
Stacy, thanks for the call. I think we scooped you from here though a little earlier in the program. We pointed that out, but we appreciate your coming into the conversation. All righty. Before I go back to the phones, I think we have to, before time gets totally away from us, we have to talk about this telephone data collection thing that everybody is talking about. However, one of the things that I've been noticing, in fact, there doesn't seem to be any meaningful public outcry to this. Am I sensing it improperly or wrongly? Therefore, the public doesn't really much care what's going on.
I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at the opinion polls, yes, it seems like there's acquiescence on the part of maybe a majority of Americans. I know the people in my family are outraged. Whenever I make some defense of the NSA data collection, they want to run me out of the house. So I think if you look at Obama supporters, I think a lot of Obama supporters are very unhappy about this. My own view is that this is very different from what we had back in the Bush warrantless wiretaps of conversations back in 2005. At that point, the president was acting on his own authority, prosecuting the war against terror. And they were listening to the content of the conversations. Under this data collection, the NSA is getting metadata, not the content of the conversation. Plus, Congress has approved. Congress has been informed. And there's a court that reviews it, a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Although, that is a secret court. And I do think it's good that we are having this discussion about whether all of this goes too far from a journalistic point of view. I am very disturbed that the Guardian reporter on this, who has most of the scoops. I'm still an old enough journalist that I believe in objectivity and an attempt to be impartial, and he doesn't. Glenn Greenwald is an advocate who has an agenda, and I think it has played into some mistakes that he has made in his pieces, overstating, for example, how much access the government has to Facebook and Google servers, for example. But back to your question, it doesn't seem like there's quite the uproar that one might.
Which puts us, I would think, on a slippery slope. Would you agree with that?
Well, Yes and no. I mean, I think the public outcry is not there because there is extreme support in the public for protecting us against terrorism. That hasn't mitigated, I don't think, since 9/11. And there was no real outcry about the Patriot Act from the public generally. You know, that's a long time ago. And the fact that all three branches of government are involved, as Bill pointed out, is huge. The government is going to want to protect the citizens and or to go after its own purposes. You know, I mean, the temptation to use government power to do what the people who are in power think is right is there. And the only protection we really have against it is to have all three branches of government involved.
Mark, did you have
also think just people have kind of got immune to this with, you know, you're used now to when you use your computer that Facebook and Google are collecting data about you and to giving you preferences. And like Bill said, you know, so I think that's one thing. The other thing is they're not listening to calls. They're keeping track of who you're calling.
The metadata. Yeah.
Yeah, the metadata. The numbers. Looking for patterns, mm-hmm. Right.
Right. All right. Well, I have to take another break, but I'm just going to throw this out very quickly while we're talking about this sort of thing. It doesn't involve telephone calls. It involves the fact that the St. Louis police chief is telling us today that he wants to put drones in the sky. Quick thoughts on that?
I think it's a good idea.
Former police board member, Mark Smith.
Okay. Because those chases are so dangerous to citizens. And you know, the police department's got a helicopter, but by the time you get the helicopter up in the air, it's too late. You can't do it. If you've got drones that you can keep in the air and then silently follow somebody who's in a chase and it saves lives, I'm all okay with it.
Okay. When we're talking chases, that's Mark Smith. Yeah. Kim, do you have a position on this?
Well, it's not much different. And Mark makes a very good point. I mean, the risk to citizens with the high-speed chases is terrible. And you know, you're chasing. You're not in a private area. You're out in public. You're following. You're chasing. Doesn't really make any difference whether it's from a drone in the sky or a car on the street.
But what if a chase is not involved? Suppose they're just putting the drones over certain neighborhoods because there's frequent trouble there.
We're all on camera all the time, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have the constitutionally, you do not have an expectation of privacy outside
the house.
You know, hence all those cameras that are taking pictures of you, they're not violating your right of privacy. If a drone goes over the street and takes a picture, it isn't either. I mean, it is a little creepy when you sort of visualize what the world of the future could be with these drones all over the place. And I think there's a lot of reaction in legislatures about drones. You know, right. I think it actually grows out of, say, farmers who don't want drones of journalists or PETA or the Humane Society going over their farms, their factory farms or their dog kennels and taking photos for that will make them look bad. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see quite a bit of legislation against using drones.
This is another instance where the legislation and lawmakers are playing catch up with what's going on. I mean, mm-hmm. We talked about drones over in Pakistan a year ago in a much different way than we're talking about drones today when the police chief of St. Louis says, let's put them above the city. Have to take another break. Let's do that now. My guests in studio for our legal roundtable discussion, Kim Jones, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our legal roundtable discussion. Let's take a couple of phone calls on things that we've talked about up to this particular point. And Licia, let's bring you in. Licia. I have so much trouble with that name because it's spelled phonetically, and I go ahead.
I always have faith in you when you do it, though, and it sounds so lovely, no matter how you mutilate my name. It's okay. My question is probably kind of naive and dumb, but I'm going to ask anyway. As far as the DNA once a person is arrested issue is concerned, am I seeing this wrong, that say I get arrested, I'm not convicted, my DNA is still on file, should I become missing or something like that?
All righty. Thank you for the call. Go ahead, Kim.
The Maryland law wouldn't allow the DNA to stay on file unless the person ended up being convicted. And that is the law that the Supreme Court upheld. And the Supreme Court thought it was important that there were certain kinds of safeguards. The swab is taken, but only from people who are arrested for serious crimes. it's banked or it's put into the data analysis only if the judge finds probable cause for the arrest, and it's kept only if they're convicted. And it can only be used for identification purposes and not for other kinds of purposes.
Thank you.
All righty.
Does that make you feel better?
I'm sure that answers the question. Let's bring in Lawrence calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Good morning. One of your panelists there said earlier, if I heard correctly, that Justice Thomas will not put his Yale law degree up on his wall.
That's what I've heard. I assume that's true. And he won't. I know he won't speak at Yale Law School.
Well, that's all very interesting. I'm sure he put it on his resume when John Danforth gave him his first position. I'm sure he had to use that. And I'm sure that Yale Law degree was a lot stronger than a law degree from some little school you never heard of. Here's a man after he got on the court, after he made it through. After the line that he did not write, high-tech lynching, he did not write that line. I think John Danforth gave it for him in a buck-up session with President Bush the First. He said, and I quote, "I will be a thorn in the side of liberals for years to come." Gentlemen, I submit to you that if you had, first of all, you wouldn't have a liberal say that. You wouldn't have a liberal identifying himself as a liberal in the Supreme Court. But if you had someone on the Supreme Court after they got appointed, let's say under this president, who said, "I will be a thorn in the side to conservatives for years to come," conservatives would rightfully lose their minds where liberals kept their mouth shut. Conservatives would be challenging that person for years to come to recuse themselves. Now, lastly, while I run him in the ground some further, he is in the Thurgood Marshall seat. But that is a big seat.
Okay, Lawrence, well, thank you for the call. I think we've determined that you're not a Clarence Thomas
fan.
Right. Yeah,
but
we thank you for your opinion.
Justice Thomas has a very complicated view towards race. I think he feels very bitter that his accomplishments are always viewed as not being as great as they might be because he got, affirmative action help along the way. It's one of the reasons that he doesn't like affirmative action. People are always saying, well, Justice Thomas just goes along with Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas really isn't that smart, and he doesn't ask any questions. And actually, the legal scholars who read Supreme Court opinions consider him among the better opinion writers and legal minds on the court. So I think sometimes we sell him short. I know that Justice Marshall certainly was hated to see Clarence Thomas take his seat, was very unhappy about that. And he has the very opposite history. I mean, it's like the other side of a coin as Thurgood Marshall.
And he got off to a very bad start during the whole confirmation process. That had something to do with it as well. Jay in Normandy, you're next. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, hi. You all talked about the Sharia law being voted or vetoed by the governor. I'm curious about this very unbelievable bill, HB 436, the, quote, Second Amendment Preservation Act that overturns or nullifies federal law. But also, these guys say they want local control, but it preempts local control. I'm looking at a copy here. It prohibits any jurisdiction that prohibits open carry of a firearm. Basically, that is lifted. So local governments, towns, cities can't control the very terrible practice of open carry. And I'd like to know the status of open carry in Missouri right now. I'm in a debate with a guy about that. So what's the status of that bill and open carry?
I don't know if we can help you win or lose your debate, because I'm not sure what the status is. But I think your overall comment is right, that the backers of this, this whole notion that federal law can't be enforced in Missouri is ridiculous. There's a supremacy clause to the that says that federal law trumps state law, and so that the legislature can pass those kinds of laws all they want, which and they apparently want to do it a lot, but it's not going to have any effect. But you're also right that then the state legislature wants to trump the people below them. They want to trump the people above them and below them, and say, okay, we're not going to let St. Louis pass some sort of really tough gun control law because we want to be able to go into St. Louis with their guns.
Yeah.
Let's move along. And this time it's going to be Dennis in Overland. Dennis, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I before I was going to do the thing about Ma Bell years ago, but I wanted to point out that George W. Bush tried to not use his family to get into business school at the University of Texas. He didn't want his dad to help him. And he didn't get in. And then he miraculously got in to, I believe it was either Harvard or Yale.
Yeah. For his, Harvard Business School. Right?
Okay, so that'll give you a little shot of, I guess, the whole idea of meritocracy. But over to the Ma Bell, I was dating a gal 40-something years ago. She worked for Ma Bell here in town. And a couple times I finally got her to quit doing it, but she would just patch me in to somebody's phone calls while they were having basically talking dirty or whatever, and I finally just and I said I said, please don't do that. But what it taught me was how easy it was to do it back then within the private sector. And but the thing with NSA that concerns me is the fact that it's outside of the government, and that I'm ambivalent. Both, on the one hand, I want them to stop things. On the other hand, I don't want them necessarily easily listening, or at least have to be accountable. And a third one is, it's really fun for people watching this issue to just tune in to Hannity and watch his gymnastics on what he thought back then and what he thinks now. So thank you, guys.
Dennis, thanks for the call. I'm glad you didn't go into more detail on some of the things you heard. I'm old enough to remember party lines, and we used to occasionally listen in on what the other parties were talking about. But that's
but it comes
story.
Back to this difference we were talking about during the break, the difference between the government listening in and a private citizen listening in. And I mean, I don't want either, but I'm much less comfortable with the government listening in.
Yeah, and the Constitution comes into play when it's government.
Yeah.
I mean, Google can use all its analytics that it wants to look at your internet searches. It's not the government. They're not violating your privacy, even if they're getting a whole lot of private information from you. It's the Fourth Amendment just protects you against the government. The caller's comment, I think goes. It's interesting. He was saying how easy it was to listen in on these conversations. You know, this Edward Snowden, either whistleblower or traitor, depending on your point of view, has said that he could listen to the president's conversations. I think some people wonder whether that's actually true, but that a person in NSA could listen to any conversation they wanted to. That's very much in contradiction to the description of the program that the government has given, which is that we collect all this metadata. In about 300 cases a year, we find a reason to look at the metadata.
Right.
And, figure out, is somebody involved in some sort of terrorist ring? I mean, it's very different. What the facts are would be something it'd be nice to know.
Well, maybe the difference between what he could do and what
might
he
be.
Was authorized to do. I mean, with technology, anybody can listen to anything, better than 40 years ago.
Right.
Or have a drone taking a picture of you through your bedroom window.
That's
because
right.
These drones, they can be made pretty small, can't they? I think about the size of your thumb in some cases.
Yeah, all this stuff can be done.
It can be done, yeah. Let's take another call. This is an issue we have not discussed today, but we have in the past. This will be David in Bourbon, Missouri. David, I hope we can help you. I know that I don't know the answer to the question you're asking, but let's go ahead.
Okay. Well, you all are dealing with some very weighty stuff this morning, but I was curious about a local case that's in and out of the news most recently. The Riverfront Times did a front-page story on former concert venue owner Jimmy Tebow.
Right.
His property was, of course, seized, and he copped a plea, got a 30-month sentence. And I'm friends with him, and I'm wondering, along with others, if he is judged to be a prisoner with good behavior, what might his prospects be for early release from that 30-month sentence, and I will stay on the phone. Thank you.
Okay, David, I think we've talked about this case before. This is the venue down in Southern Missouri.
Didn't they call it Swag Fest or something? Or?
There was marijuana being smoked during this concert or whatever it was, and the feds seized the land. Was that correct?
I think that's right. I looked this up at one point, and I've forgotten the details.
I think that's essentially it. I mean, in very broad strokes, that's it. But
you can get time off for good behavior, isn't it? Don't you have to do 80%? I don't know.
You're asking
I never
me.
Do criminal.
I work with federal law. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but wasn't he convicted under federal law? I thought it was.
Well, it was the feds that seized the property.
Yeah, yeah. So
it
I
must
don't know.
Have been a federal,
it was a federal offense. He
Yeah.
Well, they're restricted.
If
a lot.
If it's over a year, then you can get out for early.
There's no parole under federal law anymore, but you can accrue good time credits if you know when you're in prison, and that can, in some cases, lead to an earlier release.
Yeah.
Although you'd be under supervision.
Right.
While we're talking feds, at least glancing over that particular, I wish, David, that we could have been more help to you on that. I know you've written, Bill Freivogel, about the proposed federal shield law that people are talking about to protect sources, journalists protecting sources. You don't think necessarily that it would be a good thing, at least what's being proposed.
Well, yeah. I think at least that the press should raise a few more questions about it. For example, the federal shield law. I mean, it's always raised in connection with, say, the NSA story or the AP. The subpoenas of the AP reporters who had written about an undercover person within Al Qaeda. That's always the context. But what people don't pay attention to is that it would not help the reporter in those cases because there's a national security exemption. And almost certainly in those two cases, which is what they've been brought up in lately, it would not have helped. As a matter of fact, I think most First Amendment lawyers believe that in the national security cases, which the New York Times or the Washington Post might be writing stories about, that those reporters will be in a worse position rather than a better position. Also, I wonder whether or not we really want the government saying who is a journalist. I mean, the House bill that had been under consideration, for example, I wouldn't be a journalist because I don't get paid for my journalism. I get paid to be an academic, but I don't get paid for what I write for the Beacon. And so if I wouldn't be protected. And what about, I mean, more or less, this isn't all about me. What about the citizen journalist on the street? They would not
any
be
blogger.
Protected. Or blogger. You're right.
Sure.
So I just wish the press would look at it a little, instead of just like wholeheartedly embracing it, would look at it with a little bit more nuance.
We have 2 minutes left. I want to raise this this final issue, and that is, are companies all over the country now going to have to pay their interns? A New York judge ruled the interns and the film production crew of the Academy Award-winning Black Swan movie were entitled to payment with actual money. The Fair Labor Standards Act was violated by not paying them. How broad is this likely to be applied?
Well, there was a Sixth Circuit decision that came down the opposite way. But this is the first big case saying these unpaid internships are a violation of wage and hour law. I think you're going to see some employers just get more worried about it, and their general counsel is going to say, we don't need this risk. Let's stop doing this. I think there's a bigger safe harbor for not-for-profits and for government agencies, and they'll probably continue. And I think we'll see this kind of get fought out and get some more direction. But, it's gone on for a long time. There are the Department of Labor has strict guidelines, but they're very strict of what you can do, basically saying it almost has to cost you, the employer, money to offer this kind of opportunity.
So what could come of this is the fact that
people
are not bringing in interns.
I think you'll see less unpaid internships. Right, but there's still lots of paid internships out there. That's what most of our students get. So.
All righty. 30 seconds. Anybody want to add to that? Kim, Bill?
Well, there are lots of – I mean, this is a pretty important issue for our students down at SIU in Carbondale. I think one way we hope that our students can get around this, because a lot of them get unpaid internships out in Hollywood. And
right.
I think one way in which they hope they can get around it is that we offer, have the students sign up for academic credit. Now, this case in New York that you're referring to did not have academic credit, so I think we're hoping that'll be a distinction.
Okay. That's what I was thinking. If they get something of value, academic credit, community service hours, something they might be able to get around.
I think the Department of Labor is still going to be looking at what they're doing, though. Mm-hmm.
Got to leave it right there. I want to thank you all for being with us. Kim Jones, thank you. Nice to have you with us. Bill Freivogel, good to see you again. Mark Smith, same to you. We'll get together again in about a month. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Webster University's Michelle Lloyd about the afterlife in ancient Egyptian culture in connection to the St. Louis Science Center's exhibit, Lost Egypt, Ancient Secrets, Modern Science. Then we'll talk with Douglas Scott Brooks about his new history of summer vacation traditions, particularly by St. Louisans who would like to travel north. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.